From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Herbert Hoover was trained as an engineer, but when it came to fixing 1929 America, the popular verdict is that Hoover twiddled his thumbs and let the country slide into depression. Since the 90s market bubble burst, some have heard the distant echo of that 20s boom and bust. Our guest tonight says that George W. Bush should take a close look at Herbert Hoover's real legacy as what not to do to save today's economy. This hour, Herbert Hoover, George W., and the U.S. economy. But first, we begin with the newly released Al-Qaeda videotapes. Last night, CNN aired the first installment of terror tapes brought out of Afghanistan by reporter Nick Robinson. The 64 tapes are startling evidence of the scope of Al-Qaeda's training practices, with lessons on everything from making chemical weapons to shooting down aircraft. I spoke earlier with Jim Walsh, a fellow in the International Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. I asked him what the videotapes tell us about Al-Qaeda.
I think they provide a couple of things. And remember, this is only the first installment. There'll be new footage that will appear through the course of the week. But already a couple of things jump out. First, this is the first direct evidence of chemical experimentation on the part of Al-Qaeda. We had reasons to suspect that they had done some chemical work. A Al-Qaeda member turned state's evidence testified that he had seen some experiments. There were other sort of indications, but this is the most direct evidence we've had. Second, it really does provide a window on Al-Qaeda. These tapes were meant for their own personal usage, not so much for public display. So it gives a sense of what their interests are, what their priorities are, what their style and training, all those sorts of things. And there are hours and hours of that. So I think it's going to be a really rich treasure trove for scholars and intelligence analysts and just the public to get a better bead on what Al-Qaeda is and what it's up to.
Does it tell us something about how sophisticated, how serious a threat Al-Qaeda was before 9/11, how sophisticated and serious it may be now?
Well, it does insofar as that since most of these tapes were shot prior to 9/11, it gives us some sense of their history. Some of them are as much as a decade old. In terms of their current capability, it tells us less about that, only because since 9/11, they've been put under much greater pressure. They've lost their home base, Afghanistan. They're on the move, and the organization has most likely decentralized. Some people have gone to Iran, some people have gone to Chechnya, some people have gone to Kashmir. So they're under a lot more pressure than they are now, than they were before, but it still gives us a sense of the sorts of things they were interested in.
Is there a value of these tapes as historical record that somehow relates to efforts to stop terrorism today?
Absolutely. I mean, the only way that we can do a better job of preventing the future terrorist attack is by understanding the thinking and training and inclinations of the terrorists that are out there. And these tapes provide that. Bin Laden is perhaps the most videotaped terrorist in human history, and that will be useful when any of these people are brought to trial. But it's useful to people like me who are trying to figure out, well, where might they strike next? What sort of organization are they? To what extent do they really do emphasize chemical weapons or other sorts of weapons of mass destruction as compared with your regular truck bomb and TNT? So it's enormously useful, invaluable, really, for someone like me or others who are interested in trying to figure out what Al-Qaeda is up to. It's also worth pointing out that this is some of the only information coming out of Afghanistan into the public domain. At a lot of these safe houses, a lot of the training sites and camps where military and intelligence officials are on the ground, they are locking up all that material and putting it away in storage, and it is not seeing the light of day. It's only because there are some journalists out there who are out still digging in Afghanistan that we're really getting any information back.
Do you have a sense, Jim, of why these tapes ended up in the hands of CNN?
Well, I know that the senior correspondent there had made contact with this source and been in contact with him for about a month, and then the final offer came and required that he take a 17-hour drive at night. Night driving is dangerous anywhere in the developing world, and it's particularly dangerous in Afghanistan. But he went ahead and decided to make the trip, afraid that he was going to end up like Danny Pearl, but made the trip and went to a site. These had been stored in one location, were moved to a next, appear to have been buried at one point. He saw some of the tapes. There are over 200 tapes. And then he picked the best 64 that he could see and then got out of town and got back to Kabul and then onto a plane.
But are we assuming that some faction of Al-Qaeda wanted these tapes seen, or that they've fallen into the hands of people who are not Al-Qaeda who said, wow, wouldn't CNN love these?
I think either is plausible, but I would be, if I had to bet, I'd bet on the second. That it may be that these, that because Al-Qaeda has been on the run and has had to shift position and move to different places, that they have not been able to maintain control over these tapes or go through the trouble of moving with them from place to place to place. Others might have learned of their existence, and then someone might have decided to give them up. It's interesting to note that CNN does say explicitly that they paid no money for the tapes. So the question of motivation, I think, is a relevant one, but at this point we don't have a clear answer.
How valuable will the tapes be to law enforcement officials?
Well, I think they'll be very valuable. I think part of it will give us some sense of balance and context. You know, if you have just one video, and a video has Osama bin Laden or someone talking about chemical weapons, well, that's interesting. It demonstrates motivation, but it doesn't tell you how important it is. Where does chemical weapons versus other sorts of weapons, or one sort of target versus another sort of target, where do they rank? And the only way you can figure out the rankings of importance, the priorities, the organizational priorities, is to have a lot of data, a lot of hours, and then you go through and you say, well, where is it that this organization spends its R&D money? Where does it spend its training and organizational resources? That gives you a better sense of a direction or of a style or a mode of operation than a single tape that just pops up every once in a while.
The tapes were carefully concealed, spliced into tapes of TV series and movies that would look innocuous. Do you have any sense, can we tell from what you see, of how widely the tapes might have been distributed throughout an Al-Qaeda network?
Not yet. I mean, that'll be interesting to see, because presumably if they have been distributed, we should see copies of particular tapes popping up as additional people are arrested or as additional sites are uncovered. Certainly some of the tapes appear to take the form of almost an instructional video. You'll remember back in the fall, journalists found what was called the Encyclopedia of Jihad, mm-hmm. which was a written manual, a multi-volume set that was essentially an explanation, a how-to guide to becoming a terrorist. And it seems that at least some of the videos are the video equivalent of this how-to guide, you know, maybe a correspondence course in TNT, in truck bombs, in kidnappings, and the typical tactics and operations of terrorists.
Jim, you said that the tapes might shed light on what sort of organization Al-Qaeda is and where it might strike next. Have you come to any conclusions yet from what you've seen?
I haven't, only because I've got hours and hours and hours of tape yet to look at. But, you know, think back about the tapes we have seen over the course of this 11 months, we've really learned some interesting things. You'll remember back on December 13th, the Pentagon released a videotape, the so-called dinner tape, where bin Laden essentially says that he knew in advance that 9/11 was going to happen, and he tells a story jokingly about 9/11, and it's clear that he was intimately involved in the planning details. Well, that same tape also had bin Laden making numerous references to dreams and visions and religious symbology. So I expect that as we go through these tapes, they're going to be rich with details and provide still more clues about bin Laden's thinking and the organization's structure.
Jim Walsh is a fellow at the International Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He spoke with us earlier from Cambridge, Massachusetts. George W. Bush is probably hearing more than he'd like lately about Herbert Hoover. America's 43rd president has some things in common with its 31st. They both carry the free marketeer label. They both faced a tumble-down stock market. They both faced pressure to do something about it. By the time Hoover moved out of the White House, 14 million Americans were out of work and the country was mired in the Great Depression. Things are not that bad for President Bush. The stakes this time appear to be a double-dip recession. But pundits have wondered if George W. might make the same mistakes Hoover did. Hoover didn't do enough to save the economy, they say. Bush, the free marketeer, some say, risks the same do-nothing reputation. Wrong, says tonight's guest. Herbert Hoover abandoned his pro-growth principles and over-tinkered with the economy, she says. Hoover did too much. And Bush, she says, risks taking that same path. Listeners, is Herbert Hoover's handling of America's slide into depression a cautionary tale for George Bush today? What can we learn from the 1929 crash and Hoover's response? Should the government step in to help, or should the economy be left to heal itself? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York is Amity Schles, columnist for the Financial Times. Her article, The American Engineer Who Tinkered Too Much, appears in tomorrow's edition of the Financial Times. Good evening and welcome, Amity Schles.
Good evening.
Good to have you with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Amity.
Amity Schles, I have to admit there's a lot I didn't know about Herbert Hoover. Dipping back into history to prepare for the show tonight, I had no idea he was in China at the time of the Boxer Rebellion and is famous for risking his life to rescue Chinese children, that he directed all kinds of aid to Europe during and after the First World War, that he was a kind of engineer, tinkerer, humanitarian. But I do know, like every American, his reputation from 1929 and its aftermath as a cold-hearted ditherer who stood by while the country slid into depression. You say that understanding of him is all wrong.
Yes, that's his reputation, laissez-faire man. But actually, when you look at the record, you'll see a number of serious interventions that he did. And this comes out of his personality. He was an engineer, as you say. He was a tinkerer. He built his fame and greatness in fixing things. So when the Depression came along, he said, I'm going to fix this. And what were ways that he did that? Let's look at the first was farm production. Prices were going down. Mm-hmm. This was troubling. Prices were down rather much, 40% for some crops. So he spent millions and millions of dollars to pay farmers off to keep food off the market. The idea was to bring prices up, but the opposite happened because farmers were encouraged to farm yet more acreage. Now they were getting the money from government, one, and two, outsiders from other countries stepped in and took the opportunity to sell their product, and the net was the farm crisis, which was a terrible one in the Depression, worsened. Another example was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act in 1930, whose passage Hoover led. That tariff act was done as a decent sounding project. They wanted to raise revenue. In those days, tariffs were where governments got a lot of their revenue.
And they wanted to protect American industry, presumably.
Wanted to protect the farms and other industries, same thing. Big downside because it antagonized Europe. It antagonized Asia. Everyone retaliated. Suddenly, countries like Germany couldn't buy American products. They couldn't pay their old World War I debts. This is all in the encyclopedias. Mm-hmm. Trade walls emerged. You can read about this. And this led to, by the way, the fury of Japan. So you can.
If you're going to cut us out of the market, we'll build our own alternative market.
Right, Smoot-Hawley, in a way, laid the ground for the antagonisms of the 30s and World War II.
And you note that the man of money, Herbert Hoover, even took aim at Wall Street.
That's right. And by the way, I should mention all of this is written up, or much of it, in a book by Murray Rothbard. I'm not making it all up. And anyone who wants to read the whole thing, it's there. Murray Rothbard, Wall Street. We said Wall Street. He bashed it like crazy. He bashed it a lot. He hated speculators. He thought they
were. Herbert Hoover went after Wall Street, went after speculators?
Like crazy. And one of the things he particularly detested was short selling. Mm-hmm. When you bet a stock's going to go down and you make money on it. And so he organized the restrictions against short selling. But of course, the short sale contract has two partners, the guy who thinks the price is going to go down and the guy who is wagering it's going to go up.
But the bottom line is you're saying the so-called ditherer actually intervened in a way that pushed the country into depression.
Yes, it helped to push the country into depression.
And are you suggesting that George Bush risks doing more damage than good if he steps up now? He's already got farm subsidies. There are steel supports. And he has been critical, though mildly critical, some would say, of Wall Street.
Yes, well, Bush has had the sanctimonious air about Wall Street that Hoover had. And some of the other things, too, are familiar. Bush, though, has a more pro-growth attitude than Hoover did. Hoover obsessed about the deficit. Indeed, one of the terrible things he did was raise taxes at a time when businesses were very vulnerable in the early 30s. The Atlanta Constitution said that was a vicious, vicious tax law that he passed in the early 30s, hiking every tax in sight. And when you have a situation, Bush would not do that.
Amity, stand by. We're talking tonight about the lessons of Herbert Hoover. What does Herbert Hoover's example tell us today? What is the best way to keep a stock market crash from bringing down an economy? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On July 16, 1932, Herbert Hoover was nominated by the Republican Party to run for a second term in the White House. The Democrats picked Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Hoover lost, carrying only six states. But while on the campaign trail, he shared his vision of a free, financially stable America. Here's a clip of Herbert Hoover and his supporters recorded at a Republican election rally in 1932.
Is a land where men and women may walk in ordered liberty, where they may enjoy the advantages of wealth, not concentrated in the hands of a few, but diffused through opportunity to all, where they may build and safeguard their homes, give to their children the full opportunities of American life, where every man shall be respected in the faith that his conscience and his heart direct him to follow, and where people secure in their liberty shall have leisure and impulse to seek a fuller life.
That was Herbert Hoover on the campaign trail in 1932. We're talking tonight about the lessons of Herbert Hoover for the nation, for George W. Bush. What do you want from a president when the economy gets the wobbles? Has President Bush been active enough in responding to economic weakness? Has he been too active? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Amity Schlaes. She's a columnist with the Financial Times. Her op-ed piece, or column, The American Engineer Who Tinkered Too Much, appears in tomorrow's edition of the Financial Times. Jack Beatty, you heard Amity's analysis of Herbert Hoover before the break, that while he may have come in with a laissez-faire reputation, he had his mitts all over the economy trying to wrestle it away from the Wall Street bust, and that it was that very interventionist, even humanitarian impulse that may have tipped things into the Great Depression. Do you agree?
No. I think this is an interesting theory, and she's writing a book on the Great Depression, and I want to read it with interest. But she's applying a theory of laissez-faire economics. The experience, both historically, was what was it that ended the Great Depression? Massive counter-cyclical spending on the part of the federal government, to which the Roosevelt administration was most reluctant to come. Indeed, Hoover's budget deficit in 1932, in proportion, was higher than any deficit Roosevelt reached. He himself was orthodox on the subject of the balanced budget. It was only with the coming of World War II and the use of the federal government as an economic engine to drive prosperity that prosperity returned, and we got unemployment. We had full employment. We went from 14% unemployment in 1939 till 2% or so in 1942, and Roosevelt didn't realize what the winning formula was, and certainly Hoover didn't, nor did John Maynard Keynes. I mean, at the time of when Hoover was, quote, tinkering, Keynes was saying, you know, that idea of balancing the budget, that's not such a bad idea. You've got pressures of international gold situation and so on. You've got to keep the credit. Hoover was operating at the rim of economic knowledge. We have since discovered that the federal government has this counter-cyclical, that this is how you get out of steep recessions and depressions. The government stimulates the economy, and that itself creates economic activity. Hoover, William Allen White said, was the greatest innocent bystander in history. That is, he came to the presidency with a progressive outlook. He was not this laissez-faire character that we think of. Here is Herbert. We're messing his name. Herbert Hoover.
Don't go down that road.
Here he is talking about what he wanted to do as president. He says, little had been done by the government in the fields of reform or progress during the 14 years before my time, that is to say, the Republican era. He was a bull mooser in 1912. He said, I had high hopes that I might lead succeed in performing the task of a reforming government. We want to see a nation built of homeowners and farm owners. We want to see savings protected. We want to see steady jobs. We want more and more of them insured against death, accident, unemployment, and old age. We want them all secure. Franklin Roosevelt was once asked, what is the philosophy of the New Deal? He said, one word, security. Here we have Hoover saying the same thing.
But the question is all about how you get it, isn't it, Jack? And the question is still today how you get it. Amity Schles, you write in tomorrow's Financial Times that Hoover's story is a reminder that benevolent action can sometimes be more destructive than inaction. So which is it? Do we need now in a time of weakness the government to come in as an engine for economic growth, or to stay out of the way and let the economy kind of blow its cold wind through, blow out the cobwebs, and get a fresh start?
Well, I'd say stay out of the way. But first, in defense of Hoover, he thought he did a New Deal. He thought he had already done a New Deal. And in the same period of the tape that we just heard, mm-hmm. 1932, he also said, we mounted the most gigantic program of economic defense and counterattack ever evolved in the history of the Republic. No government has ever done so much and taken so much responsibility. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. He thought he had done a New Deal, and while the federal budget as a share of GDP didn't increase so very much, when you include state expenditures, how big is overall government as a share of the economy, it went up from 14% to 18% under Hoover. That is, there was a large increase in government presence in the economy in the Hoover period.
Well, are you saying then that he thought he had done it, but he was somehow less successful than FDR, or did it take, as Jack Beatty says,
I don't think FDR was that successful.
Well, I guess that's the point. Did it take a world war to pull the country out of that? And that's something we don't want to repeat as a you know, medicine.
No. But there are a number of things. Recall that it took 8 years for GDP to get back where it was at the point of the crash. So those were many, many years in the experience of Americans' lifetimes where things did not get better despite Hoover's little New Deal, FDR's true New Deal. FDR had a recession right towards the end, just before World War II, mm-hmm. of his own, his depression, and then a dip, the FDR depression recession. So I'm not sure that spending let us out of it, nor even the spending of World War II. What let us out of the depression was our relative position compared to other countries, that that there was opportunity to make weapons and sell them, but I'm not sure it was the spending per se. No.
Let's bring our callers in. A lot of them want to join. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I don't expect Murray Rothbard to ever come up with the idea that any sort of intervention ever did anything good. From
a conservative economist and one who's passed on.
Libertarian or proprietarian minarchist, more properly. Mm-hmm. I've spoken with relatives who lived through the Great Depression, mm-hmm. and their general sense of Hoover feeds my general sense that he may have intervened, but he wasn't thought of as being interventionist. There's no idea that there was going to be any sort of consistent work in favor of the people who were suffering. And so that each individual act, though they may have amounted to, a lot more than a proprietarian minarchist may have wanted, that it still gave no impression that anything in particular was happening.
But, David, you take from that, then, that if the country had believed that he was going to intervene forcefully, that might have been the kick in the pants that the economy needed to get going again?
I have no idea. The Great Depression was worldwide. Mm-hmm. And, of course, again, to Rothbard, every single government was too interventionist. So it's hard to say.
So then what's the issue? If the country just didn't understand him to be interventionist, what, in your mind, were the implications of that?
I think part of it is that he embarked on a course of action that he didn't sell quite as well as he could have, and to throw in a red herring, I don't think the bonus march and the after effects of that helped very much either.
David, stay with us.
Yes.
Amity Schles or Jack, what about this? Here we've got, again, a president who, on the one hand, wants to be seen as doing something, but just as obviously doesn't want to do a lot of things.
Yeah, and this was especially true with aid to individuals. Hoover thought it would corrupt the character to have any sort of works program. My father was unemployed when Hoover was president and sort of living out some subsistence agriculture in New Hampshire. He had a job when FDR was president. He built Camp Devens in Harvard, Mass., which up until just 4 or 5 years ago was still operating, pretty good investment. Post offices all over the nation were built by people on the WPA, and I'm sure Brother Rothbard must have regretted those impositions on the free market. You know, someone once asked John Maynard Keynes, you change your mind when the facts change. And he said, yes, sir, what do you do? And everybody in the Depression had to change their minds when the facts were changing.
Well, but I'd like to interrupt here and point out that one of the great untold stories of the Depression, because we have revised it. We have revised it mightily in the decades that we tried to recall it and explain it, was that people also did not want aid. They wanted help. They wanted the ability to save themselves. But many people did not want to be on the dole. That's where that phrase originates from. They wanted an economy that would give them an individual chance. In my book, I've been working on letters to Mrs. Roosevelt from people. One woman sent her engagement ring to Mrs. Roosevelt in hock, so that Mrs. Roosevelt would send her baby diapers and get her through that period. And
she was willing to give up her engagement ring to get those things.
And for pride. And one of the achievements, and I hear I completely agree with Jack, one of the achievements was the individual integrity of the people and also Roosevelt's leadership. He was a better communicator. I asked my grandmother once, what was it about Roosevelt? And she said, well, Dolly, what it was about Roosevelt that was so great, he was so good on television.
Which, of course, there was no.
There was no television, but she remembered the fireside chat. And you can have a leader who connects with the people.
That's a presence, all right.
You can have one who doesn't.
Emily, I want to ask you, Emily Schlaes, to our caller David's observation that while Hoover may have been prepared to intervene, he didn't come across as interventionist or sufficiently active, and he was, of course, flayed by his opponents in Congress as callous and cruel.
He didn't come off as if he cared. And when you're in pain, you want someone who cares. But that's a separate issue from someone who actually helps set the economy into a circumstance where it can grow again. And he wasn't that either.
David, thank you for your call. Fritz is calling from Richland Center, Wisconsin. Hello, Fritz. You're on the air. Hello, Fritz. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. What interests me is that that George Bush used 9/11, September 11th, as the excuse to to bust the budget, to increase military spending by approximately 33%, if I'm not mistaken. So there is an analogy between between Herbert Hoover 29-30 and the previously referred to increase for different projects.
Fritz, we got that. Let me put it to Amity Schlaes, and thank you for your call. Amity, what about the issue when you've got a bust on Wall Street and the economy looks wobbly, you've got budgets to tend to, and you've got tax issues to consider? Are the parallels here between how Hoover approached the problem and what we see in the Bush administration, similarities, differences?
Well, the great similarity has yet to come. If Bush focuses obsessively on the deficit, which is what Hoover did in 1931-32 toward the end, and says, I'm going to do anything to erase that deficit, including huge tax increases, then that will repeat the pattern. The one big similarity that you see in the Bush administration now is this idea that you have to have a big demonstration of action. That is like Hoover and it's like FDR. And maybe that is necessary politically. You can't just, when the stock NASDAQ goes down 75% from its high, you may want to politically show you're going to do something, but it's not necessarily necessary economically. In fact, it can hurt. For example, when you look at the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, which is the recent corporate responsibility legislation, there's a downside to that, too. We haven't focused on it. When all these executives have to sign these oaths of integrity, that's all right. Maybe that's all right. We don't want executives who are criminals. But it also opens corporations up to outrageous class action lawsuits on a shareholder class action lawsuits on a scope that we haven't seen lately, and that will hurt stock prices, which will hurt pensioners.
Amity Schles, let me just ask you on that point: how does a nation respond when it feels, or the evidence suggests, that it's gotten off base? That business ethics in this instance, and business books, have gotten crooked and really out of line to a point that it's almost criminal. You appear to be suggesting, well, let it work itself out. But what does that mean if the government doesn't somehow push back?
It's a two-point story. Point A is you clean it up, and that's what we tried to do with this law. You show lawbreakers that they can't do that. But point B is you say, yes, now indeed the economy is in a fragile situation. What can I do to really make someone want to be an entrepreneur now? And you want to be sure you don't do anything that would discourage that, the entrepreneurship. So now we want, you know, it is valuable, for example, to have tax cuts now. Everyone says, oh, the president is being irresponsible about that. He's not, because if taxes are lower, people will want to get back to business. They will want the unease to pass. They will start to do new things. Capital will flow from inefficient, overrated areas, maybe we can call telecom that, to newer, less discovered areas. And if you scare the economy to death, that can't happen. And precisely scaring the economy to death, that's what happened in the Great Depression. The Wall Street Journal wrote a beautiful editorial in the late 30s about the economy, and there was supposed to be an easing of credit, and that was supposed to be important. And the Wall Street Journal said companies desperately need not money, capital, but better reasons for borrowing and for undertaking the utilization of money. And when you have so much good intervention, it's a problem, because companies are afraid that suddenly and violently their behavior, their framework is going to be distorted by the government. That is, the government's going to jump in and make their business bet go sour.
Jack Beatty, are we risking killing the golden goose with this attack on what's been called crony capitalism?
No, not at all. I just don't accept that at all. I mean, the problem is a crisis of belief in the institutions of capitalism. We have a crisis very analogous to what happened then. Then the stock market was heavily manipulated. Then the Treasury Department, in its version of deregulation, allowed people to buy stock on very little, 10% down. Then the brokerage firms maintained what was called Morgan's preferred list, that Morgan steered investments to politicians, Jacob Raskob, the chairman of the Democratic Party, for example, and others. And today we have the exact same thing. We had a kind of preferred list by one of the big brokerage firms, which was steering IPO issuings to a company, to executives of companies whose business the brokerage firm wanted. So we had this great era of deregulation, and what we've had in both cases is a crisis of that old order. We had a crisis of that old order in 1929. It went smash. And we've had a crisis of it today. It has gone smash. And I think the very thing that Amity is talking about, this picture of the deregulation, that economies recover on their own, that if Hoover had only done nothing, everything would have been fine, that's the advice he got from Andrew Mellon, his Secretary of the Treasury. It didn't work. It's not how historically we got out of the Depression. And government just sitting by isn't going to be the way we deal with our current problems either.
Well, I hear two big views here. Amity, Jack, please stand by. Listeners, should this be a hands-off moment for the government on the economy, or a hands-on moment, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the lessons we can draw from Herbert Hoover in his unsuccessful effort to keep the stock market crash of 1929 from turning into what became the Great Depression. The question is, then and now, I guess especially now, should this be a hands-off moment for the government on the economy, or a hands-on moment? Are we better off bearing economic pain or cushioning it now? What is the best path now? Back to economic growth. Our guest tonight is Amity Schles. She's a columnist for the Financial Times, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Amity Schles, I want to get one thing out of the way. When you look at the current situation and compare it to what Herbert Hoover faced and what the country actually came to experience in the decade of the Great Depression, is George W., is he operating in the face of the same magnitude of risk that turned out to be floating over Herbert Hoover? Is there a depression way out there in the wings now if we don't handle this right, or is it really just another recession that we're talking about?
There's always a depression way out there in the rings if we don't handle things right, out in the wings. But right now, no, it doesn't look like a depression. It doesn't look like that magnitude at all. And one reason, actually, is that we do allow stock markets, successful markets, to act and capital to be rational, to go to new areas, to go out of overfunded areas such as telecom. We do allow the NASDAQ to pop. When it's time, we don't say, oh no, the NASDAQ is popping, we have to stop that. So we are, in many ways, relatively inactive, and that's painful to watch, to see when you have WorldCom, to see that WorldCom go down. That's terrible.
Inactive in not stepping in to prop up companies.
Excuse me?
Inactive in not stepping in to try and prop things up.
We are not stepping in the way that we could. And because of that, we're less likely to have a depression.
Jack Beatty, when you look out at the American kind of center of gravity today, we went through a decade or more of quite a love affair with the market. That's part of the learning curve now, and a lot of people have participated in Wall Street for a while for glory and now for some pain. What's your sense of where Americans want to see government today in terms of intervention, non-intervention?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I have no polling data on that. It's clear that the public wanted something very strong done about the corporate scandals. It's clear that the public is confused at the benefits and risks of deregulation, especially in the financial markets. But part of our problem today, I think, is that our political vocabulary has so shrunken. In the 1920s, this Peoria has been studied now for, I think, 60 years. And in the 20s, the feeling about young people are asked, if you fail in life, is it your fault or is it the fault of conditions? In the 20s, most people nearly said, it is my fault. Well, we went through a long period, the 30s, the 40s, where people said in the 30s, strikingly, no, it's not really my fault. We understand there are these big impersonal forces. And in the 60s, that's pretty much stayed that way. But in the 80s and 90s, we were right back to that individualism. If I fail, it's my fault. In other words, globalization puts me out of work. That's my fault. And our communitarian vocabulary has been impoverished precisely because we have forgotten Franklin Roosevelt. And here's what Franklin Roosevelt believed. I'm quoting from Raymond Moley, his assistant. He believed that government not only could but should achieve the subordination of private interest to collective interest, substitute cooperation for the mad scramble of selfish individualism. He had a profound feeling for the underdog, a real sense of the critical imbalance of economic life, a very keen awareness that political democracy could not exist side by side with economic plutocracy. We are such strangers to that kind of thinking, and yet we have had the rebirth of an immense plutocracy in the last 20 years.
But Amity Schles, I sense in your writing a kind of a welcoming of the fact that the communitarian vocabulary may have been diminished. That may just be undergrowth that you see in the way of economic growth.
Well, it's nice to be a community, a private community. It's nice to be a national community. It's important to be a community in a war. It's not necessarily good to be a public sector community, especially not for growth. Moley, the same fellow that Jack quoted, later complained bitterly about Roosevelt's tax policy and said his soak the rich and corporate tax proposals represent a complete departure from the principles of taxation for revenue and reform that he meant that would lead to growth. And what I would argue that some of the legacies of the New Deal, precisely that communitarian expectation that government will take care, are hurting the economy today. For example, our greatest economic problem is probably domestically Social Security. we exaggerated Roosevelt's promise by increasing Social Security beyond terms that he ever dreamed of, and now that is a fiscal budgetary crisis because we can't pay for the expanded Social Security, Medicare, prescription drugs, which are really legacies, expanded legacies of the New Deal.
Mm-hmm. And which have made it possible for people like my parents to retire in dignity and to pay for their medical expenses in dignity, and that have all but abolished poverty among the elderly.
And
Social Security
very,
and Medicare are
difficult.
One of the great achievements of this civilization.
And which have made it very difficult for younger people to earn a lot of money. Today, when you pay Social Security as a young person, the rate that you pay just for your side, which does not include, of course, your employer's side, he matches it, is higher than the tax rate a millionaire paid when the income tax was first invented.
Mm.
That rate, which is the highest tax for 75% of Americans, payroll tax, does not mean that you'll get the money either. So it was a very, very good deal, of course, for older people who deserved it because many of them worked hard all their life. Many of them were losers in the Depression. We all wish them well, but generationally, it is a bad deal, and it hobbles the economic prospects and future security of anybody under 50.
Mind the gap, listeners, because there's a big one opening up right there. I want to get at least one more call in here. Brian is on the line. Welcome, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a couple of comments about tax cuts. I think, you know, the Bush tax cut is sort of staggered over 10 years. I don't think it's a response to stimulate the economy in the short term. Excuse me. And I guess I'd take issue with your guest's view of things. I think the, you know, we've had a, as your other guest has said, this plutocracy over the last, say, 10 years or so with the economic boom. we've had, you know, wealthy people who don't pay their fair share of taxes as they probably should. And we've had, I think we have a crisis in confidence in the market, and that's where I think the government should step in and do something. I don't think they should do a whole lot, but they certainly can do a lot more than what they've done so far. And it certainly wouldn't have been, you know, something that Bush would have done.
Brian, thanks for calling. I love the crickets in your backyard there. Amity Schles, there's the other view here, that this plutocracy got so far out of hand. We've all seen the numbers, what's happened with CEO compensation. We've seen the
There are a few of those plutocrats, but you have to remember, top 5% of taxpayers pay half the taxes. That's a greater share than that they've carried in our memory.
Yes, but that's related to income.
Rich do pay a lot of taxes.
But there's a fundamental concern here about fairness at some level that you can hear in Brian's
Well, I think it's pretty darn fair when the top 5% pay half. That's more than fair. That's over than fair.
Well, but if all that indicates
is the top 5% paying proportionally.
But if all that indicates is that they're making so much money,
well,
that
what's wrong with? Do we hate people who make money? If we do, let's be honest about it. But the there's nothing wrong with people getting rich in America.
But you know, but what about
gaps have narrowed in America and did in the 90s?
Do you see nothing corrosive though in that what we saw is that exploding gap between CEO compensation, for example, and ordinary workers, went from what a multiple of 40 to 500?
Well, yeah,
doesn't that inevitably create a kind of tension?
I see something wrong with that, but I don't see it as a proxy for the whole economy or raising taxes on dentists, which is the next step. You can say, well, they shouldn't make it, and guess what? A lot of them are paying for that, how much they made Tycho, Kozlowski, but they're paying for taking too much. But whether you translate that into taxing every professional more than he is already taxed, which is necessarily what it ends up becoming in terms of legislation, that's not a pro-growth step.
We've just got a minute left. Herbert Hoover lived until 1964. He was 90 years old when he died in 64. It surprised me that he had lived that long. Amity Schles, do you know anything about how his thinking matured?
Very interesting point. You know the expression, apology for one's own life? Hoover was very invested in being a humanitarian. He thought he was a good guy, and he had indeed done a lot of good. So imagine the personal pain of being labeled the creator of Hooverville's shanty towns when he had thought he was a great savior.
Brutal to live
and
with.
Brutal personally, and he wrote several volumes of memoir defending himself, first saying how he did his own New Deal, then attacking Roosevelt from the right. So there was a lot of regret and pain in his life.
It's still hard to shake that label once it's on. Amity Schles, Financial Times columnist, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Amity Schles' article, The American Engineer Who Tinkered Too Much, appears in tomorrow's edition of the Financial Times. And Jack Beattie, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can listen to President Hoover's 1929 inauguration address at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, hell and high water in Prague. This is On Point. Floodwaters have slowly begun to recede in Prague, where heavy flooding forced more than 200,000 Czechs to flee their homes. A dozen people lost their lives in the worst flooding in more than a century. Alfredo Azula is managing editor at the Prague Post. In this radio diary, he shares what it was like to watch his city disappear under the water.
The transportation system in the center of Prague is completely paralyzed. Most of the metro subway stops have been flooded. Only a portion of the electric trams that run through the city are running. Most of the bridges are closed. There's only one bridge you can drive cars over, which is creating massive traffic jams. I had to cross the river, and I took a cab, and a trip that should have taken 15 minutes took an hour and a half. Campo Island, which is a very popular tourist destination in the middle of the Vltava River, was completely submerged. It's home to some historic buildings, restaurants. It's just amazing to see it underwater. The embassy district in Malostrana, which is some of the most quaint and beautiful buildings in Prague, water all the way up to, you know, fourth, fifth story windows. In other places, all you see is the very tops of telephone booths poking out above the waterline. A flood like this is a disaster that's happening in slow motion. So there's lots of time for people to gawk and watch the water slowly rise. It took several days before the river finally overflowed its banks. So for the first few days, we had the surreal spectacle of thousands of people lining across along the riverbanks, tourists and residents, watching the river become wilder and wilder. And finally just shock when it finally did begin to overflow. And when it began to flow finally, it rose very quickly in the neighborhoods. There were people trapped because they weren't taking the sit warning seriously. Towards the end, there were people who had to be evacuated by boat and by helicopter. The tourists had quite an experience. At first, it was fun for them watching the floodwaters and slowly rise and the river becoming wilder. But on Wednesday night, when the authorities thought that the Old Town Square was going to flood, they evacuated the tourists who were staying in the hotels near the river at 4 o'clock in the morning, which I'm sure did not make for a good vacation experience. We had reports of people wandering around lost with luggage, not knowing where to go because they don't speak the language, and the people who were evacuating them didn't speak their language. This has brought the tourist season, of course, to a crashing halt, and the economic impact of this will be rather severe. There's been mixed reaction to how the government has handled this. They've come under severe criticism from some places for not preparing for this. In 1997, the country experienced devastating floods, and I think a lot of people thought that the government had learned its lesson from that. There were some places we were prepared. We were able to protect the Old Town Square, which is one of the most beautiful places in Prague. But certainly the zoo was not given enough warning, and several large and valuable animals had to be destroyed, including an elephant, a hippopotamus, a bear, and it was a tragic situation there. The damage estimates are in the billions of crowns. This will be the most devastating and expensive flood in the history of the Czech Republic. The cleanup effort is going to take months. The economic impact will be felt for years.
Alfredo Azula is managing editor of the Prague Post. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Bosnian.